Victory or death!
Victory or death! Victory or death! Victory or death! Victory or death!
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Radio Free Virginia. I'm your host, Hank Reardon. And this is episode 21-19, the 19th episode of 2021. And in today's episode, I'm going to talk about a couple different things. But first, let me tell you how you can listen. You can find out more about the show at radiofreevirginia.com. The best way that I've found to listen is either with the Stitcher or the Podbean app. I'm sure there are others. Maybe you've got your preference. That's fine. You can probably find the show that way. But if you go to radiofreevirginia.com, you can find out more about the show and then also find the Podbean link and other things like that. So that's what I would recommend you do if you want to find out more. Also, please share this with others. That's how I keep doing what I'm doing and want to spend the hours that are involved in putting a show together, and it is quite time consuming. I'm going to talk about masks a little bit, the racism, woke, critical race theory culture that's happening right now. Going to talk about how cops aren't going to protect you. A good, interesting article about that that I found at Western Rifle Shooters. And of course, again, I Led Three Lives. This will actually be the final chapter. The final thing in I Led Three Lives, actually the epilogue, which would be, I guess, chapter 20, but finished chapter 19. It's all about the testimony last week. And I'm going to, as well, I've started digging into trying to find some more information, see what kind of headlines was this making in the day. What I wanted to do was dig up some digital copies of the communist publication, The Daily Worker. But they don't have anything online, even as far back as 1936 is pretty much as far back you can go in the Daily Worker, and even that is not great. The communists really went underground after the trial of the 11. And when they did, I'm sure that the orders were burn everything. So a lot of those old copies of The Daily Worker and things like that are just gone. It's entirely possible there's some in a barn somewhere, but nobody has yet found those. And when they do, they probably look at this and go, nobody wants this junk. What I wanted to see was what was the historical aspect of the communists and their feelings and their viewpoints about Herb, and wanted to see the propaganda they were churning out. But I couldn't find it. But I did find some articles that were written about him and about the trial, and I think provide some good perspective. I'll talk about Herb, his life, and up to his death and his surviving family. But first, let me tell you about today's sponsor. It's Acticare of the Blue Ridge, ACTIKARE.com/blue-ridge. Acticare is in-home senior care for your senior loved one when you can't be there. If you're in Smith Mountain Lake, Bedford, Roanoke, Campbell County, Lynchburg, out in the country, get in touch with them and see what they can do to take care of your loved one. ACTIKARE.com/blue-ridge. And make sure you tell them you heard about them on Radio Free Virginia. And if you're interested in being a sponsor on this show, get in touch with me at radiofreevirginia.com. All right, let's talk about masks. So we all thought it was kind of strange, and we started to ask the question, well, if vaccines work, why do we all have to still keep wearing masks? And I think the CDC and the Fauci farce crew and everyone else up there started to ask that question too, or moreover, have it asked to them. And they went, you know, these people have a good point. We can't keep selling this whole vaccine is actually working sales pitch if we're telling people they have to keep wearing a mask even after they're vaccinated. First off, vaccine doesn't work. Not a vaccine, second off. And third off, masks don't work. But they had to kind of admit that, oh, yeah, if you've been vaccinated, you don't have to keep wearing a mask. Oh, you can if you want to. And so this has led to a whole bunch of stuff happening across the United States, governors lifting orders and lifting restrictions and doing different things, and continuing this farce. Anecdotally, masks don't work, because if they did, everybody that ate out at a restaurant would get sick. Everybody that went to a sporting event would get sick. Everybody that went to church would get sick. And on and on and on it goes. They say that we can't safely educate our kids. Well, if that was true, then all the private schools would be full of sick, infected kids. But that hasn't happened. And this virus, which has a 99.99% or greater survival rate, has led to the destruction and the shutdown of massive industries. And you're seeing shortages at the store. You're seeing massive inflation across various different things. And the summer's not even here. So this would be the best time of year for many businesses, and yet now they're on hold. And what on hold means to a business, if you think about it, it's not just, well, we're just going to have to wait. Well, that's easier said than done, but you can't pay employees to sit around on their butt and do nothing. So that means you have to start cutting hours, laying people off. You have to have a crew that is paid and working. And if you have to, and if you're not going to pay them, a lot of those guys will go work somewhere else. And now you have to find a new guy and train a new guy and hire a new guy when that stuff does come in, whether that's lumber or steel or whatever. You can't just shut the economy down. And so that's where we're at with this farce. And there's a lot of people that don't want to admit it's a farce. They are just doing everything they can to defend this thing still. Oh, well, you know. And that's because they've invested in this lie that they've told themselves, and they can't admit that it isn't real. And so here we are. But one way or another, we're getting somewhat life back to normal. And I would just say that, think about this in a logical sense. If the vaccine works, then the only one I'm putting at risk, if I don't get the vaccine, is me. And it's my body, my choice. So I'm going to exercise that choice and not get the vaccine. You do what you want. But I would encourage you not to get it. All right, I'm going to talk now about how the cops aren't going to protect you. And this is from a site called Tactical Wisdom. Found this actually through Western Rifle Shooters. They're always a wealth of good radical conservative thought. And the title is Self-Defense is Over. Everyone said wait until they come to Texas. Those cops here won't play that. Then they came to Texas and the cops protected BLM, Antifa. But that was Austin, they all said. Then they went to Plano, Texas. There, BLM Antifa blocked traffic. One motorist pictured above, there's a picture in the article, and some of you have seen this, got angry and walked to the front, demanding that the crowd unblock the road. He was threatened and yelled at. He said, "Where are the cops?" Then he found a police officer and demanded that officer clear the road. It's worth noting that the man was legally in the right, and as a motorist, he had every right to drive down the road. BLM Antifa had no right to block the traffic. So what did the Plano police officer do? He warned the man to get back in the car and shut up. As the man started to walk away, the crowd closed in on him. And when he told them to back off, a man in the crowd pulled a firearm on the man in full view of the police officer. And you can see that in the picture. Again, the officer ordered the man to return to his vehicle and took no action on the felony assault committed directly in front of him. The person who drew the gun cannot claim self-defense, as they were part of a crowd facing one man. They were not where they had a legal right to be. They have no right to block traffic. And they were not the innocent victim of attack. If you are committing a crime, you cannot use self-defense. I personally had a similar situation occur in Lansing, Michigan a few months back when Antifa was attacking a man in a crowd. When I waded in and told Antifa to let the victim up, one of them drew an expanded baton on me and ordered me to back up. I told him that I was not backing up, and he threatened to strike me in the head with the baton while we were standing right next to a Michigan State trooper. I demanded the trooper take action on the felony assault occurring right in front of him, and he said he could not. The police aren't coming to help you. During the same week, we saw multiple armed confrontations in Portland. In one, Antifa set up an illegal armed checkpoint manned with vehicles blocking the road and several people with long guns. As you can see, the red pickup was boxed in front by a red Jeep. He was approached from all sides by armed personnel, and he exited the vehicle, demanding that they move. They kept ordering him back into his vehicle at gunpoint, which they had no legal right to do. At one point, a male armed with a long gun shoved the man, knocked him down, as he was on the ground and surrounded by armed men. The subject drew his handgun and got up. He was immediately jumped by the crowd, and his gun was stolen. The crowd, which was illegally blocking traffic, had no right to assault the man or to disarm him. So what did Portland police do? Nothing, because they weren't there and didn't arrive until much later. What does this mean for us, as people into preparedness? It means that you cannot rely on the police to help you, and you cannot rely on the law to protect you if you resist the BLM Antifa mob. Our best defense is to practice the martial art of don't be their jitsu. That's funny. And avoid these situations, as I've recommended before. Monitor Facebook and Twitter feeds of known activist groups in your area so that you can be aware of planned actions, so that you can avoid being trapped in one. If, despite your best efforts, you find yourself trapped in a protest, the best thing you can do is pull your car to the side, lock it, and leave on foot. I disagree with that. Have a get-home bag in your car, always ready to go. That's good advice. You can't rely on just sitting in the car, because people have been violently pulled from their cars and beaten. If you're absolutely trapped and they demand that you make some sort of display like raising the fist or shouting Black Lives Matter, the safest route is to just do it. It doesn't mean you believe in it. Just make it through the incident. Again, I disagree with that. But, I mean, it makes sense from a tactical self-defense standpoint, but I don't agree that we should be capitulating in any way to these people. I'll get more into that in a second. I recommend once again buying and wearing some type of wearable body camera. That's good advice, and they're not expensive. I have a couple always with me, and if things look like they may go bad, I start recording. Don't rely on using your phone. That ties up your hands, and you may need them to make a phone call. Even if it's obvious that the police are there, make a phone call to 911 and get it on the recorded lines that you're being unlawfully stopped at a roadblock and in fear for your life because there are armed people outside your car. It could be a crucial piece of evidence later on. The biggest takeaway that you need from this situation is to be aware that the police aren't going to help you and that the traditional self-defense laws are not necessarily going to be applied to protest cases. Remain aware and always have a plan to leave on foot if needed should a protest develop. Okay, so let's break this situation down. One, you don't need to confront a mob. I agree with this guy. He's in his right to say, get the heck off the road. I agree that the police aren't doing their jobs. And frankly, I think if you're going to be a police officer and you're not going to enforce the law on the bad guys, you should quit. The absurdity of this, that you're not stopping these people. Or moreover, it should just be made a law that if people are blocking the road, you're allowed to just run them over. But last I heard, this guy was charged for what, I don't know. But there's time and again where we've seen Antifa and BLM basically having the cops looking on and doing nothing over and over again. And these people are learning. These criminals are learning that, hey, we can do whatever we want. And when they do arrest us, we get a month in jail, if we're lucky. And it's a suspended sentence so that we only have to serve it on the weekends. This is great. So they're learning real quick that the police aren't there to protect you. And unfortunately, in a lot of cases, the police are there to protect them. What needs to happen is a course of action I can't suggest without myself breaking some laws. So I won't suggest it, but you know what I'm saying. At some point, Americans, that'd be you and me, are going to have to stand up to these people and deal with them. And you can insert whatever deal with them means to you. But the police You have police departments all over being having their budget slashed. It was already a job that was hard, but you had to deal with a lot of garbage. You had to deal with garbage leadership, and now that's so much worse. But I've said, you know, when it comes to the gun issue of, you know, the police enforcing those laws or whatever, or the police coming in and allowing the FBI to come in and do things, they're not the problem. It's the prosecutors. It's the judges. It's the bureaucrats at various levels, local, state, and federal. They're the problem. So if it comes time where we have to deal with this problem on that side, which should be the good guys, right? Then dealing with police officers isn't going to do anything. They'll find some other dummy that's willing to take $25,000 a year and do whatever he's going to do, whatever they order him to do. Hey, make sure you don't mess with these protesters and don't let anybody mess with them. Protesters. I use that term loosely. Next up is a clip by Glenn Beck. And I came across this on a show I occasionally listen to called The Armchair Survivalist, and he had it on there. I have shortened it for time. I will have a link in the show notes where you can find the entire thing if you want to dive deeper into this issue. But this woke industrial complex with the critical race theory and everything else has its roots in Marxism, communism. And they're using what I think Glenn Beck is missing here in his description of this is that he's talking about this from a standpoint simply of Marxism and not talking about it from the standpoint of Chinese communism. Because Maoist communism has its roots in racism because they needed to have a dividing thing to create struggle. And that dividing thing was racism. Because everybody was poor in China. And so, that's what they did. Divided people by race and got them to hate each other. And that's what they're doing here. The left talks a good game about how much they care, about how much we have a free and a fair and equitable and equality and all these fancy words that they like to use. They don't believe any of them. They want division. They crave it. They feed off of it. And so, listen more, and hopefully you'll learn a few things here. I know I did, about critical race theory and this whole infiltration in our society about this.
I mean, police say it's too soon to tell whether victims were targeted because of their race. But
the killer said himself that it wasn't about race.
And yet,
people are calling for new laws to protect Asian Americans.
Surge in hate crimes against Asian Americans only getting worse.
It's like it's open season on people who look like me, who look like my parents.
Attacks against Asian Americans have reached a crisis point.
All of this is thanks to critical race theory, an ideology that puts race above all else. Your values, your skills and talents, your dreams, desires, they're all wiped out and put in place instead is the new defining aspect of your life, your skin color. I know it started at the nation's universities. That's the breeding ground for far-left ideologues. But it's now spreading not only to our young kids.
Other people of color experience other forms of racism too. But you won't see any of that if you don't see color.
But into every aspect of our society as well. It's a manipulated attempt to control you. But fight it, and they will take you down.
I feel helpless. You know, there's nothing you can do about it.
So tonight, we study the threat. We identify it and watch how it spreads.
Critical race theory is making its way into our after-school programs.
Then, what we can do to put it in its place. Tonight, Critical Race Tyranny, the Great Reset of Education.
Hello, America, and welcome to the program. Probably
the most important thing that we can do is take care of our children. Our children are under attack. The entire house is truly on fire. And we keep saying, look at this fire, look at this fire, look at this fire. But our children are trapped inside, as you will understand. There is nothing more important than our children. We are at a precarious position in our nation right now. There are many cultural threats ripping at the fabric of America. But I believe the most dangerous existential threat to the United States is happening in your own family. It's critical race theory, often referred to as CRT. Let me just recap real quick in case you don't know what critical race theory is. It is an ideology flooding the universities, now our public schools, all the way down to kindergarten, which elevates race as the most important aspect of a person's identity. Take everything you learned from Martin Luther King and flip it on top of its head, and you have critical race theory. It preaches racial oppression as the singular ruling factor that explains everything about American history and Western society. It teaches that white supremacy is essentially like, I don't know, the Force in Star Wars. Whiteness surrounds us. It penetrates us. It binds the galaxy together. Except it's not a good force. And according to CRT, it divides the nation into two groups. You're either racist and part of the problem, or you are an anti-racist fighting to reverse this power structure. But so you know, the only way to truly reverse it is to destroy everything that has been built. Now, when I say critical race theory is an existential threat to America, it is because it is victim-based philosophy. It's a divisive message that is completely un-American and I think anti-people, anti-soul, anti-individual. It will destroy every aspiration and hope in our children. CRT is gaining momentum, and it is being preached now in schools all across the U.S. If you believe this is not in your school system, you are wrong. I don't care where you are. And the consequences for daring to disagree with CRT include being branded a racist, getting kicked out of the public square, even seeing your livelihood ruined. Is there anything more important than your children? Now, it may not be a Soviet-style gulag yet, but the punishment for dissent of its own kind has its own special exile for you. So social justice simply creates more injustice. It all has a very Marxist ring to it, and that's not a coincidence, as you'll see in a moment. Now, when critical race theory takes over as the truth that explains everything in life, it is truly like a religion. It leads to op-eds like this one just a few weeks ago after the mass shooting in Atlanta. Whiteness is a pandemic. Now, this writer of the piece, Damon Young, says, listen to this. Whiteness is a public health crisis. It shortens life expectancies. It pollutes air. It constricts equilibrium. It devastates forests. It melts ice caps. It sparks and funds wars. It flattens dialects. It infests consciousness. And it kills people. Now, how can whiteness do that? Because that's critical race theory. It's not whiteness. They define whiteness as everything that you would associate with the, well, I was going to say Western way of life, but it's common sense. Being a person of merit is described as whiteness. Being on time is whiteness. Striving to be better is whiteness. It's extremely racist, but it is also extremely devastating to anyone who adopts this theory. CRT is a direct descendant of critical theory, which was born where all really bad ideas are born, in Germany in the 1920s. It was known as the Frankfurt School. Now, the Frankfurt School is its original name was going to be the Institute for Marxism. Now, remember what was brewing in Germany. Marxism, socialism, national socialism, Nazism, and all of the ideas that one race could wipe the other race out. This is part of all of that. But the school's founders, after the war, they were like, you know, maybe we should camouflage some of the Marxist roots here, go for a safer sounding name. And what could be safer than the Institute for Social Research in Frankfurt? Critical theory held that there are no universal truths. From the start, it was all about talking about and attacking Western culture and institutions to destroy them. Remember, Marxism, it's communism or national socialism back in the time, and it was all about destroying the Western way of life. They don't believe that man can rule himself. In the 1930s, when the Nazis came to power in Germany, the Frankfurt School's critical theory professors escaped because they were not national socialists, they were communists. Where did they go? Well, they came to New York, and they went to Columbia University, which welcomed them in. One of those Marxist professors, a guy named Herbert Marcuse, grew frustrated with the American working class because they're not agitated enough. I mean, what's wrong with them? They seem to be happy. He felt that they had been duped into believing capitalism and the American dream was a good thing, but it was actually enslaving. This is the Marxist concept of masters dominating slaves, the bourgeoisie exploiting the proletariat. Now, according to Marx, that situation was not sustainable. In the long run, it's the working class are going to revolt against their masters. But that didn't work. And after the civil rights and Vietnam protest movements, Marcuse discovered a whole new market of minorities to exploit by focusing on their oppression. There is always somebody that can see something real and turn it into something hideous and evil. This was the seed of the critical race theory. He saw what Malcolm X was preaching, not Martin Luther King. And he realized, if we can get this into the university and let it germinate for several decades, we could grow something that would kill this system. Well, CRT uses that Marxist formula, except now white people are the bourgeoisie, dominating and exploiting the people of color who are now the proletariat. Whites, you see, have all of the power. People of color have none. So CRT is all about flipping that narrative. So now it's anti-racism. It's a version of Marxism, working class result or revolt. You've got to rise up against white culture and white people. It's not about creating a more equal society, because Marx never does that. It's all about transferring power from white oppressors to oppress people of color. But even that doesn't matter. There are white people involved in this and black people involved, and it doesn't matter. It's all about power and money for whomever can get the job done. Last year, George Floyd's death and the resulting BLM riots caused critical race theory to escape the labs of academia and super spread through the culture almost overnight. Suddenly, the media, pro sports, corporations, all on board with the idea that America is hopelessly racist, and thereby everything, including capitalism, must be dismantled and destroyed. CRT has gone mainstream, and the all-encompassing anti-racism movement has created an atmosphere of guilt and fear that Columbia professor John McWhorter calls a, quote, totalitarian and unnecessary kind of cultural reprogramming. This reprogramming can be seen in things like this educational program on whiteness from the National Museum for African American History. In recent months, the whiteness pandemic has caused panic on college campuses all over the U.S. At Princeton, hundreds of faculty members sent a letter to the university president endorsing critical race theory. Their letters declare, quote, anti-blackness is foundational to America. And it includes a long list of demands on how to make Princeton an anti-racist institution. It kills me. The institution that is most closely associated with the biggest racist in American history, Woodrow Wilson. Tufts University in Massachusetts announced that it will spend $25 million to become an anti-racist campus, because all it really takes is money, right? This effort includes replacing art displays with more racially diverse content. Apparently, artists are frontline workers in the whiteness pandemic. Earlier this month, a former law professor released the Whitest Law Schools in America report. It says, quote, the higher the score, the more inappropriately white the school. Can you even imagine this being said, that it is an inappropriately black school? The deans at Case Western University Law School in Ohio were not pleased with their ranking in that report, so they emailed the student body chastising them for being too white just a few weeks ago. Barrera College in Kentucky held an event titled White Citizenship as Terrorism. At the University of Maryland, black student leaders submitted a list of demands, including, get this, putting notations on the transcripts of students accused of hate speech. Accused. They also demanded mandatory racial bias training for students and staff and, of course, defunding the campus police. Stanford University launched the Youth Justice Lab to examine how to dismantle structural racism in the U.S. public school system and put an anti-racist education in its place. They claim things like merit-based grading policies are insidious forms of state-sponsored racial segregation. The University of Washington announced it is launching a Center for Anti-Racism in Nursing, focused on addressing systematic racism in healthcare, because the number one problem facing American healthcare is racism. You heard it at the beginning of the segment. Whiteness kills people. Well, thanks to critical race theory, healthcare isn't the only thing we now know is racist. Math is as well. The Mathematical Science Research Institute in Berkeley, California, is presenting a workshop for college professors this summer called Mathematics and Racial Justice. Examples of CRT madness like this occur almost daily everywhere in this country. At this point, you'd expect from the university system nothing but this. And it's easy to laugh it off as a crackpot scheme that remained behind the ivy walls of college campuses. But with CRT, academia created a monster. And that monster is now stomping down Main Street, USA, like Godzilla, focused on the next conquest, your children's school. Many public school systems across the nation are buying into critical race theory, and CRT is targeting schools. Besides the obvious that CRT's proponents want America's kids indoctrinated with the CRT worldview, there is this reasoning from former education professor Gloria Ladston Billings. She writes, critical race theory sees the official school curriculum as a culturally specific artifact designed to maintain a white supremacist master script. So under the assumption that everything is racist, state boards of education are getting serious about overhauling curriculums and reprogramming their teachers. Last fall, Ohio's educational department created a resource for social studies teachers, and they called it Anti-Racist Allyship Starter Pack. It contained dozens of recommended readings, including an article called The Souls of White Folk. Its author says whiteness is a stone idol in the mind of white people in America that must be smashed into pieces like the idols of pre-Islamic Arabia. Unless this happens, there is no absolution possible, end quote. Other items on the recommended reading list for your children: How White Women's Tears Threaten Black Existence, When Feminism is White Supremacy and Heals, White People Have No Culture, and Forget Looting, Capitalism is the Real Robbery. Earlier this month in Illinois, Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker signed a bill that established a 22-person Inclusive American History Commission that will evaluate the current social studies curriculum, quote, through the lens of equity and social justice. The commission is tasked with ensuring the inclusion of non-dominant cultural narratives. The bill also requires the schools to develop a curriculum focused on black history from 3000 BCE to 1619, including the study of reasons black people were enslaved. Then there's this little note from the Oregon Department of Education, 82-page guide to dismantling racism in math, which tells teachers that asking students to show their work in math class is a form of white supremacy. Bet you didn't know that. Or this, quote, white supremacy culture infiltrates math classrooms and everyday teacher actions. So Oregon instructs its math teachers to, quote, identify and challenge the ways that math is used to uphold capitalist, imperialist, and racist views. Great. American students already suck at math compared to the rest of the developed world, I'm sure we're going to get real good. Now they're going to be suckier at it, if that were a word, while we try to fix the out-of-control racism in math. But don't worry. California has been hard at work for the past few years developing the model curriculum for the nation. This is not going to stay in California, nor has it. It is a new ethnic studies requirement that will be the only education a student needs in his new America that runs on critical race theory. California's ethnic studies curriculum has multiple radical contributors who are dedicated to the decades-old movement known as liberated ethnic studies. Advocates of this movement say there's more than just a different way of teaching American history. It's a philosophy described as narrative medicine, radical healing, and a way of life. One of the writers of the ethnic studies curriculum is Guadalupe Cardona. She is an LA public school intervention counselor who was fired from a teaching position in 2018 after the parents found out she's a proud member of a Marxist organization called Union del Barrio. According to the group's manifesto, they are devoted to expelling European imperialists from the Western Hemisphere. They want to form a single geopolitical unit called Nuestra America, from the southern tip of South America to Alaska. Ultimately, quoting, advancing Simon Bolivier's dream of a unified continent. In an earlier draft of the new ethnic studies curriculum, these activists included a lesson on Palestinian resistance to the oppressive state of Israel as an example of ethnic studies in action. When that lesson was removed from a later draft of the curriculum and a lesson on anti-Semitism was added, Cardona and others complained that whiteness and Zionism were flexing their power. For over a year, the liberated ethnic studies activists have hosted webinars sharing their radical views of what ethnic studies should look like in California schools. This is California University professor Stevie Ruiz during one of those webinars. Watch.
Inside of the United States, Native people have been actively fighting a long war to dismantle the United States. So then we can actually think about, well, what happens if we honor Native people's acknowledgments and begin to tear apart the United States internally? What if we decide to call this place the United States no longer? All the horrific that white people have been doing to us has now begun to haunt them. And so because they've been experimenting on us for 500 years, it's no longer something you can contain anymore.
Tear apart the United States internally. That might as well be the title of this new curriculum. The original co-chair of the committee designing the ethnic studies program argues that white Christians committed theocide against Native tribes in America that killed their gods and replaced them with Christianity. As a way to reverse that oppression, the ethnic studies curriculum includes a community chant for their teachers to lead in their classes. Students clap and chant to five Aztec gods, which were traditionally worshipped with hundreds of thousands of sacrificed humans. The student chant words in various languages, asking the gods for power to be warriors, for social justice, for a revolutionary spirit, and for liberation, transformation, and decolonization. Are we insane? The critical race theory mania is sweeping the nation. It is McCarthyism on steroids. Instead of searching for communism under every rock, it's now whiteness. And we are calling on ancient Aztec gods. May God protect America. And I'm not sure we deserve it much longer, if we even deserve it now.
It's important to be an empowered individual.
A life worth living is a life where you stand in your personal power and sovereignty.
By taking another step to grow and empower yourself every day.
And we're here because we want to help empower you.
We want to help.
We want to help you embrace personal power the only way that's socially acceptable today.
By victimizing yourself. We want to help you victimize yourself so that you too can be an empowered individual.
Some people aren't hurt by others. but they want to be.
That's why you need to victimize yourself.
Feeling significant because you made yourself into a victim is a lot easier than feeling significant because you did something significant.
The more significant you feel, the more power you feel. And the more victim you are, the more significant you feel.
Which makes you feel more powerful.
We as a society need more self-made victims.
And you can be more of a victim than you ever thought possible. You just have to believe. We're here to help. Just listen. To victimize yourself, find someone else to blame for how you make yourself feel.
Tell them why it's their fault.
Everything about you and your life is their fault, and they need to know that.
Your feelings are their fault because they're yours.
They might have trouble understanding why it's their fault. Typical abuser.
That's, of course, because they don't care about you.
If they cared, they would already know what they did to you in your mind. How could they? But because they probably won't understand, explain it to them in simple terms by getting rageful.
The angrier you get and the louder you scream, the more wrong they are.
That way they'll understand that the scope of pain you're causing yourself is their fault.
The more pain you have, the more significant you feel. That's convenient.
Victimize yourself even further by canceling them.
Canceling people is one of the most loving ways to victimize yourself.
Canceling a whole group is even better. Ruin their lives because your life already feels ruined.
Hate them and hurt them because you hurt inside. As you cancel them, now is the time to virtue signal.
Do this by accusing them of being something horrible.
This will set up a manipulative psychological trick where you plant yourself to be the opposite of that horrible something.
Which is always something virtuous.
So it could sound like, you're hateful, you're uninclusive, you're racist.
Virtue signaling! And don't worry, it doesn't matter if they're not racist. This isn't about them, this is about you.
And you're about hurting others for your gain of a heightened degree of significance.
But always remember to virtue signal. That's really important.
That way, people won't see what you're really doing.
Abusing others to position yourself as the victim.
So always virtue signal.
And we can't do it alone. We need to band together with other people who victimize themselves.
Form a group to cancel people.
Form a culture.
Call it cancel culture if you want. Because if there's one thing that's more empowering than disempowering yourself and blaming someone else for it,
it's being in a whole community of people who try to empower themselves by disempowering themselves and blaming other people for it.
We all need to band together with people who attack others in order to victimize themselves.
Just like how cancer cells are more empowered when they band together and attack the body, you are too.
It pays to victimize yourself.
It feels good.
But the hard part of victimizing yourself is no one can do it to you. Other than you.
That's why we're here to help you.
So you can be better at making yourself feel worse so you can feel better about yourself when you attack someone else. It's hard. So hard.
Why can't someone else do it for you?
Socialism would help you with this.
Self-responsibility? It's more like toxic responsibility. The world needs less self-responsibility and more safe space for people to be unself-responsible.
Start today. Victimize yourself.
Blame someone else.
Feel significant. Repeat often.
By victimizing yourself, you're not only empowering yourself, you're helping create a better world.
The first important thing you can do is to be sure you know what communism really is and how socialism ties in with it. In other words, know your enemy. Above all, get understanding. Know both communism and socialism for what they are, and what they are not, how they operate, what their goals are, why some people are attracted to them. Well, how do you go finding out the facts? Well, like every other step I shall give you, it's easy. Once you start, why, you've made a good beginning already if you've seen the other two films in this series. That's the title of the first one, What is Communism? You'll know why J. Edgar Hoover warns it's the greatest threat in our world today. And the second film, What's the difference between communism and socialism? You'll find out that socialism is not a softer substitute or possible prevention for communism, but may lead to it. There are good books on the subject waiting for you at your public library, or at least there should be.
Chapter 20, Epilogue. God grants liberty only to those who love it and are always ready to guard and defend it. Senator Daniel Webster of New Hampshire, 1834. In recounting the conspiracy as I saw it, I have tried to show factually some of the things about the party that are not generally known and to indicate some of the reasons why communists act the way they do. In appraising the party, its philosophy, and its threat to America, I've tried to take the view of a peace-loving Christian pro-American. It is my earnest hope that my personal history may make an affirmative contribution, however small, to better understanding of the very real nature of the enemy we face. It is certainly not my desire to create greater misunderstanding, more hatred, or more fear. What is a communist? In what may loosely be described as the whole party, there are many different kinds. The power-hungry leader, the sheep-like follower, the very poor, the very rich, the social outcast, the misanthrope, the arrogant intellectual, the dangerously deceptive psychopath. Perhaps the neophyte communist can speak with the unashamed truth when he declares, a bit wistfully, that he clings to a dream of a bright new world without war, without poverty, without hunger. Perhaps that was the dream of Karl Marx. But the seeds of Marxism bear evil fruit. When put into practice, the theories of Karl Marx become, in all essential elements, a criminal code of behavior. The methods used by followers of Lenin, Stalin, and Mao Zedong are depraved, and any new world the communists create becomes a nightmare instead of a dream. The people's democracies are reverse prisons where honest people are locked up and the gangsters are the wardens. Wherever communism touches the lives of people, whether in the free world or in the prison of nations, there is heartbreak, sorrow, disaster, and death. The great fraud of this century is the promotion and sale of tyranny in the package labeled social progress. Time after time, I learned in my party experiences that the communist movement is not genuinely anti-fascist any more than it is genuinely in favor of civil liberties, better housing, peace, or any other cause its leaders so ardently espouse. If every basis for communist discontent today were suddenly removed and their every demand granted, tomorrow the professional leaders of the Communist Party would find or provoke new causes of discontent and would draw up a fresh list of demands. Any suggestion that the country is moving toward fascism is always greeted in the communist press and party pronouncements with rejoicing. However much it may be disguised by righteous indignation, the professional communist is another breed. He is neither a sheep nor a dupe. He knows precisely and exactly what he is doing. His goal is power, total, relentless, invulnerable, and irreversible power. He believes in science and materialism rather than in ideals and emotion. But all of these are merely tools for him to use to manipulate others, and he uses these tools with great skill. He is specially trained to be all things to all men. In order to achieve maximum success, he carefully cultivates the proper veneer to conceal his motives and intent. The most highly skilled and the most dangerous communist is often a man of charm, wit, social standing, good manners, executive ability, achievement, or with a high IQ. Certainly, he will not carry a dagger in his teeth, wear a long black coat, or convey the slightest hint of conspiracy. Thus, he plans not only to escape detection, but he hopes that gullible, trusting Americans, even when faced with cold facts, will insist, why, he couldn't possibly be a criminal, he's too nice, or brilliant, or rich, or handsome, or successful. Therein lies the reason why so many inherently loyal citizens, unwilling to think evil of any man, not understanding and perhaps unable to comprehend the criminal mind of the totally committed Marxist-Leninists, are misled into sympathy and support for communists as well as their fellow traveling collaborators and their supposedly worthy causes. The communist seems to be fascinated by his highly developed ability to carry out party objectives while behaving like a non-communist in the midst of anti-communists. He seems to derive a grim thrill out of taking the risks involved with being a communist. The practice of deception becomes so much a pattern of his behavior that he will often use deceptive methods even when it is unnecessary. It becomes a way of life. He is taught to distrust everyone, including members of the party itself, and with good reason. Most members of the Communist International, who have come to a violent end, have been dispatched by other communists, not by anti-communists. At the same time, his complete dedication to the historic mission seems to be equally matched with fanatic zeal. He will work long hours, pass days or even months away from his family, alienate his friends, betray non-communists who trust him, even go to jail. Whereas the communist seems to find some enjoyment from all this. Once one grasps and fully understands the true nature of communism, it then becomes easy to understand the well-intentioned but uninformed do-gooders are of no match for the hardcore communists. The amateur boxer may have a splendid physique. He may go to church every Sunday. He may love his mother. He may train every week at his local YMCA. But if you put him in the ring with a professional prize fighter, he will not only lose, he will be pulverized. Amateurs can't win against professionals. Yet United States policy for years has been to send well-intentioned, well-meaning amateurs, in the Cold War sense of the word, all over the world to match wits with superbly trained Soviet agents. It is this state of affairs which caused University of Plano, Texas, President Robert Morris, to exclaim, in the title of his book, No Wonder We Are Losing. What, then, can the average citizen do as his part in the war against communism? The most important first step is to avoid behaving the way communists say the individual must behave in a capitalist society. If the communist had his way, he would force all non-communists into either one of two camps— the camp of National Socialism, leading towards fascism and state control, or the camp of International Socialism, calling for a united front with the world proletarian movement. Either way is counted as a victory for the communists. The communist seeks by every means to create a split in our society, to provoke class and racial hatred and intense conflict. All capitalist governments, the communist is taught, inevitably become states of fascist oppression, thus creating the demand for a violent revolution as the only possible cure. However, if we do not behave in that manner, we will contribute to the downfall of communism. There is a middle ground, and we must cling to that middle ground tenaciously. If we adhere to our traditional American dream of a society of freedom, of personal rather than state responsibility, of individual rather than collective power, and of civil rights rather than rigid civil controls, then we will have disproved the communist theory of the inevitability of capitalist deterioration. It is true that the evils of society provide the communists with their fuel. We must readily admit those faults and work tirelessly to eliminate them. But in doing so, we must lead a positive political and social life, not a negative, bitter, or denunciatory life. We must beware that we are not led into the trap of vocally attacking things that are wrong with America, while remaining silent about the things that are right with America. For that is exactly the trap into which the communists, who are against America, hope to lead us. We have the most truly revolutionary form of government in the world. Under our form of government, we have not only enjoyed the greatest material blessings of any other society in the world, but we also have more freedom, more liberty, more independence, more freedom of speech, more of everything that would enhance human dignity than any other society in history. To preserve that which we have and to carry it forward, we, all of us, need to study and restudy the great ideas and ideals of the intellectual giants who helped form this nation. Nothing can be achieved based on ignorance, but there is everything to be achieved based upon knowledge. But of equal importance to our knowledge of and dedication to all that America means is an equivalent knowledge about communism, what it is, what it intends to do, how it intends to do it, and based upon that knowledge, an intelligent commitment against communism. A long time ago, the distinguished educators and writers, Harry and Bernardo Overstreet, What We Must Know About Communism, declared, "Time has come when each of us is obligated to study the character of this new force which claims the human future as its own, and to convert such knowledge into awareness of what is at stake and what needs to be done." Dr. Fred Schwartz, director of the Christian Anti-Communism Crusade, an organization which has probably done more to teach people the basics about communist theory and practice, similarly wrote, "You can trust communists to be communists," that in the battle against communism, there is no substitute for accurate, specific knowledge. Yet today, on every hand, there is widespread evidence of misunderstanding about communism. A reading of the Congressional Record on any given day will reveal that although many of our elected representatives are aware of the danger and reality of communism, there are others who have yet to learn even the most rudimentary facts about communist theory and practice. But if the people were informed, uninformed politicians would simply not be elected. Most of our leading colleges and universities today can boast qualified experts in the field of communism. Yet whenever the public must consider matters of great importance to the future of freedom, such as Red China, or Vietnam, or our national defense, some of our most influential commentators and columnists seem more inclined to interview those who are either left-wingers, anti-American, or both. Such practices must be attributed to either a crude disregard for truth or because simply of an abysmal lack of knowledge about communism in the highest management circles of our communications media. I am personally convinced that it is the latter, rather than any conscious subversion on the part of executive leadership. But conscious or unconscious, the result is the same. America is attacked, condemned, vilified. The evil and horror of communism is either ignored or denied. Such misinformation, repeated often, can bring disaster. Freedom is nourished by truth. It can be killed by falsehood. The communist depends upon hatred, uncertainty, and fear. Let the ruling classes tremble, wrote Karl Marx. The best answer for that is reaffirmation of the faith that ours is a nation, and we are a people founded upon belief in God and the sanctity of each individual. Therein lies our strength. The communists believe only in the strength and the will of the party. We believe that the strongest nation is the one which has the greatest possible individual freedom. But there can be no individual freedom without equivalent individual responsibility. Really good stuff. Hope you've enjoyed the reading of I Led Three Lives. It will be my plan over the next couple months to compile everything. And I'm going to see if I can get it up on Amazon as an audiobook. But if that doesn't work, I'll find a way to make it available as one whole entire thing so that people can hear about this story. Let's look at Herb Philbrick. And let's look at some of the what the articles were saying. Boston, April 9th, 1950. What kind of a man is this fellow who, in quiet, casual tone, dropped a bombshell into the trial of the 11 communists in New York, exposing the party to the sheepish chagrin and dismay of all its workers? Herbert A. Philbrick, a quiet, self-effacing, genial, smiling, thin man. He was known by sight to hundreds of Bostonians, including the movie picture editors of all Boston newspapers, as an assistant to Harry Browning, publicity director of the erstwhile M&P Theaters, since dissolved. He was a familiar figure at premieres and picture openings. He was known by sight in every radio studio in Boston. He was a familiar face to bond sellers, fundraisers, committee members, and public officials who never could remember his name because he never emphasized it. He stood on platforms in Boston Common selling war bonds with such stars as Dorothy L'Amour. But when the photographer's bulbs flashed, he was standing behind somebody else, hid in the limelight. A member of the Communist Party in Boston, Mr. Philbrick hid from his comrades the very place they would never expect to find him, in the public limelight. He was everybody's acquaintance and nobody's friend. Radio Row, the Movie Belt, the Tub Thumpers, and the Variety Club were all as dumbfounded as the communists to discover that the friendly, agreeable kid from Melrose, Massachusetts, was a counter-espionage agent reporting to the FBI week by week what the communists were up to. He led a double life so convincingly that George A. Rice, who lives next door to him in Melrose, shared the same common garage driveway with him for 8 years under the impression all that while that Mr. Philbrick had a job in radio in Boston. He was a pillar of the First Baptist Church of Wakefield, editor of the church publication, Tall Spire. He devoted so much time to church work that Reverend Ralph J. Berthoff, as astonished as everyone else who knows Mr. Philbrick, could not see how he had the time to do anything else. 11 of his neighbors canvassed on Tremont Street, rubbed their chins, wrinkled their brows, scouring memories of the Philbricks, and confessed they knew them well. They were nice, friendly neighbors who had four daughters, but that's all as far as they could go. For the first time, it dawned upon them that although they had visited the Philbricks and that Philbricks had visited them, Mr. Philbrick had carried on long neighborly conversations without even revealing anything about himself. For 8 years, as he had been a cog in the M&P organization, scores of employees worked shoulder to shoulder with him every day. The theater managers in the chain talked with him every week. They read the dispatches from New York unbelieving, asking each other, "Is that Herbie Philbrick?" When the M&P theater chain divided into the American Theaters Corp and the New England Theaters Company, Mr. Philbrick went to American Theaters as assistant to Paul Levi, director of publicity and promotion. Mr. Philbrick was a hard and conscious worker. He had been earmarked for promotion, and during the past 3 months, Mr. Levi had been shouldering more and more responsibility upon Mr. Philbrick. For the past 12 weeks, Mr. Philbrick has been coming into the drama departments of Boston newspapers and calling on newspapermen attending to various chores in connection with films about to be played in Boston. He talked freely about his films, but he never spoke about himself. Without disguise, and merely by playing himself in business, and his home neighborhood, and his church, while at the same time attending communist meetings, discussions, and policy gatherings, he was playing a part perhaps more unbelievable and nevertheless as dramatic as the principal role of a picture he was promoting. Reverend Mr. Berthoff characterized Mr. Philbrick as a good Christian, deeply religious. He did a heavy share of his church work. He was past president of the Mr. and Mrs. Club, which meant he had to be a good mixer and to bring married couples together. He did the job and did it well. He accepted every church assignment and prosecuted it with enthusiasm. There were times when he disappeared, apparently for business reasons. He never talked about communism in any of the church or young people's gatherings. When he was called on to speak, he usually said but a few words and there excused himself. He was never known to talk communism, or even to use common key words usually associated with communism, either in his church or business life. No acquaintance could be found who ever heard him mention communism. Born in Boston, May 11, 1915, son of Guy and Alice Philbrick, he attended grammar and high schools there. His teachers recalled him as a friendly boy, always smiling and popular among his classmates. Francis Rooney Jr., a teacher in Somerville High School, had Philbrick as a student in his English class. He remembered him as a capable, bright, and competent youngster. Philbrick was graduated in 1933 under his picture in the class yearbook. It appears the enigmatic legend, "Do you believe me yet, or shall I call antiquity from the old schools of Greece?" He specialized in science and physics under John P. Brennan of that department, who classified him as a bright and apt student. Mr. Philbrick came to the M&P theaters in 1942. It is now assumed he was working with the FBI even at that time. His associates recall he did not serve in the Army, but he never revealed his draft classification or the reason why he did not serve. He became instead an ardent war bond salesman and was assigned to that work throughout the movie industry drive. As far as his communist association is concerned, all that could be learned is that as a leader among the youth workers at the First Baptist Church of Wakefield, Mr. Philbrick was flooded with literature sent out by communist front organizations designed to persuade young people to join. Mr. Philbrick became interested, set out to find out about them, answered an appeal to youth leaders and churches. It is believed, reported what happened at the first meeting to the FBI. It is probable the suggestion was made that he return to further meetings, and Mr. Philbrick followed the path and climbed the ladder from the first front organization to the next, reporting each step to the FBI as an unpaid volunteer. I can't remember the name of the paper I found that in. I found it at the Library of Congress, actually. They've got scanned papers from way, way back, and here's a couple others. This is from the Sydney Herald. It's actually Sydney, Montana, I believe. Wednesday, September 21st, 1960, so 10 years after the trial. Herbert Philbrick to speak October 12th at Williston, North Dakota. Herbert Philbrick, citizen communist and counter-spy, is a man who, according to Time magazine, postponed his own life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness to get to the bottom of the great communist conspiracy in the U.S. Philbrick, who speaks in Williston on October 12th at the Field House under the auspices of the JCs, Knights of Columbus, VFW, and the American Legion, made one of the greatest sacrifices a man can make, devoting 9 years of his life in the dangerous triple role. The decision to go underground as a communist while working as an FBI counterspy was a difficult one for Philbrick to make. Back in 1940, he was a young advertising executive on the threshold of a fine career. Recently married, he was active in community and church affairs. Despite the tug of family responsibilities and community loyalty, Philbrick had a sound sense of patriotic responsibility. He knew he could be of immeasurable services to his country in working from within the ranks of the communists, and he took the fateful step. When he did, he knew that at any moment his communist affiliation might be discovered, that he could be arrested for subversive activities. He could expect no recognition or help from the FBI if it did happen, and there would be no exit. His career would end, and his family would be in disgrace. Physically, the burden of his triple role was heavy. After days at work, Philbrick had to spend long hours at communist cell meetings, planning, writing pamphlets, listening to endless indoctrinating lectures. When he finally was able to get home, he spent hours hidden in the attic room, writing detailed reports to the FBI. Philbrick points with pride to his wife, who stood by him through the 9 years ordeal. "She is living proof that a woman can keep a secret," he says. With the exception of the FBI, Eva Philbrick was the only other person who knew all about her husband's activities. With immense courage, she supported her husband as he became more deeply involved in communist activity. About her role in the ordeal, J. Edgar Hoover wrote to Mrs. Philbrick that her husband's victories were undoubtedly attributable, in no small part, to the additional responsibilities assumed by you and to your loyal and faithful devotion to your husband and to your country. Even after he could relinquish his roles as communist and counter-spy following his testimony in the trial of the 11 top U.S. Reds in 1949, it was some months until he and his family could settle down to a new life. Notes and threats of retaliation poured into him, and for several months, the entire family was under FBI protection. Now, the Philbricks live in the suburb of New York City. They have 5 daughters, aged 4 to 14, all blonde, and each with their own distinct personality. Recently, a son was added to the family. And this other one here is from just a little snippet from this one. It's a letter to the editor that was written after Herb had come and spoke to the local high school. "Many people want to know what we can do to fight communism as an individual. J. Edgar Hoover says, be informed. Learn to recognize communism. I feel that we should discuss it and take stands against it. Read Hoover's book, Masters of Deceit, Order Senate Documents, number 117 of the 84th Congress, second session. I wish that every citizen could have sat in on the discussions that evolved with Herb Philbrick when he was here in Sydney. Those that heard his lecture heard only a small part of the information that he related. When Philbrick was first scheduled to speak here, many people expressed the opinion that it was politics. I don't believe either of the major political parties are free of infiltration by the communists. It is surprising how many people took up such expression. Another common remark regarding Philbrick was, there's been too much talk on communism. The truth is that we know and have heard too little regarding it. I ran across the following recently and feel that it should be a sincere acceptance to every true American. I do not choose to be a common man. It is my right to be uncommon, if I can. I seek opportunity, not security. I do not wish to be a kept citizen, humbled and dulled by having the state look after me. I wish to take the calculated risks, to dream and build, and fail and to succeed. I refuse to barter incentive for a dole. I prefer the challenges of life to the guaranteed existence, the thrill of fulfillment to the state of calm utopia. I will not trade freedom for beneficence, nor dignity for a handout. It is my heritage to think and act for myself, enjoy the benefit of my creations, and to face the world boldly and say, this I have done. All this is what it means to me to be an American. Sincerely yours, Math J. Dassinger." Herbert Arthur Philbrick, May 11th, 1915. To August 16, 1993, was a Boston area advertising executive who was encouraged by the FBI to infiltrate the Communist Party USA between 1940 and 1949. His autobiography was the basis for the 1950s television series I Led Three Lives. This is from Wikipedia, and I'm interested in sharing with you just the later years of his life. Philbrick retired to the home of his youth in the Little Boar's Head district of Northampton, New Hampshire. He remained active, giving speeches and encouraging youth and adult citizens to exercise their political rights and power, admonishing his listeners to be ever watchful against those who would undermine the Republican form of government. Toward the end of his life, he owned and ran a variety store in Rye Beach, New Hampshire. He claimed that he stopped traveling under assumed names and watching for people following him. On August 16, 1993, Philbrick died in his Northampton home. Philbrick was father to 6 children. With his first wife, Eva, Dale, Brenda, Leslie, Connie, Sandra, Herbert Jr. He had a daughter, Dawn, with his second wife, Shirley Philbrick. Philbrick's personal papers were acquired by the Manuscript Division of the Library of Congress, where they are made available to researchers. and I clicked over on the link to the Library of Congress's website. And there are 126,000 items. Holy cow. 290 containers plus one oversized plus one top secret. That's one I'd like to read. It shouldn't be top secret anymore. That should have been declassified. Unfortunately, this stuff is not available digitally. So in box 8 through 13, we have reports, correspondence, handbills, transcripts, notes, newspaper clippings, and other printed materials related to Philbrick's activities within the Communist Party, his work as an informant for the FBI, and his testimony regarding American communism, arranged alphabetically by topic and chronologically therein. Trying to see here what the top secret material has. Oh, it looks like they have all this stuff in hard copy. If anybody who's interested, I'd love to go up there. I've always wanted to go up to the Library of Congress and poke around and see old things, and this might be interesting to do sometime. But that would involve going to D.C., and what fun is that these days? So there you have it, the conclusion of I Led Three Lives. I would encourage you to get yourself a hard copy of this. It'd be a good thing to have up on your shelf. And I hope you learned something about communists and how they're up to no good. Truly, truly up to no good. And that hasn't changed. I hope you learned something about their methods, their methodology, the way they infiltrate organizations and the things that they do. And as you can see, or as you've heard, this hasn't changed. Not at all. I'll leave you with this funny quote from a movie called Volunteers. And it's with Tom Hanks, John Candy, and a bunch of other famous people now. And basically, Tom Tuttle, it's one of the characters played by John Candy, is captured by the communists. And they brainwash him. And this is the result of their brainwashing. Have a listen.
With imperialism, the bureaucrats, the big landlord class, and the reactionary section of the intelligentsia attached to them.
Very good, Tom. You quote the chairman well.
Our enemies are all around us. We must always be on our guard. Sure, we'll lose a lot of snooze time, but that's okay. We'll catch up after the revolution's over.
That's enough, Tom.
The leading force behind our revolution is the industrial proletariat. Our closest friends are the entire semi-proletariat and the petty bourgeoisie!
That's enough, Tom.
But there's so much more.
I said that's enough! The time has come to tell you your mission.
Oh, yes, my mission. I'd like that very much, comrade.
Good. Tom, the bridge you were building for the lying, malignant, stick-infested Yankee Peace Corps. That bridge is important to us. It gives us an easy access across the river. We can drive our brand new people's truck across it and plaster the words of the chairman on every tree, rock, and animal for miles until we run out of the people's gas.
Yes.
You, Tom Tuttle of Tacoma, are going to ensure that that bridge is built and that no one in Lung Ta interferes with our plans.
In a week, I'll have that village running like Peking.
And if someone does stand in your way...
No!
Enough.
It's pretty funny stuff. Okay, well, that's going to wrap it up here. I am curious for some feedback from you as the listeners. And some of you have my phone number. You can message me on Signal. Some of you can do it through the website. You could comment on the Podbean app. But I would like to know where you would like to see the show go. Now that a good chunk of it for the last 5 months has been reading I Led Three Lives as a part of the show, there's lots of great books out there that I could incorporate into this. There's one called The Naked Communist by Leon Skousen. Now, that has already been made into an audiobook, but I could cover that. Regardless, there's lots of topics, lots of things I could talk about that would be useful to patriots like yourselves in the fight to preserve your liberty, especially here in Virginia. Whether it's history or current events or whatever, but I'm open to suggestion. I've got some ideas and I've got some things that I plan to do and I'll definitely be talking about, but I am interested. What do you want to hear about? What do you want to learn about? Because it might be perfectly in line with what I'm interested in and it would work out well. So shoot me an email at producer@radiofreevirginia.com or drop a comment, shoot me a text message, and let me know. Regardless, have a wonderful week. And remember, you were not made to fit in. You were born to stand out. This is Radio Free Virginia. I'm Hank Reardon. God bless you.